Creative Babble.
You're just laying there in the dark, and I would have these, I had a reoccurring nightmare of men chasing me, and a lot of it through just different, like, woods and fields.
Marie Walsh wakes up in a cold sweat. Her heart is pumping as fast as it can.
It was kind of a, you know, a bad dream.
Every night, it was the same dream over and over again. If only she could roll over and just tell her husband the truth. But she can't. Tonight, she's going to have to suffer alone. Marie Walsh was running.
And I finally eluded them. I got away from them by going down to this stream that I was very familiar with when I was a child, that I hung out at every day when I was third and fourth grade or something, real young. And I thought, and it was real dense woods. So I thought I would know how to, I knew that I could evade them now because I knew the territory. And I'd finally gotten away and I was finally free and they wouldn't be able to catch me. And I woke up feeling really happy. So I thought that was kind of interesting that my dream after all those years of being a nightmare, I'd finally gotten away.
But what was Marie running from? After all, she was just a middle-aged suburban mom who lived a pretty unremarkable life.
The label that I got was the soccer mom. And, you know, basically that's kind of what I did.
Every day pretty much revolved around her kids.
I was a stay-at-home mom just doing volunteer in their classrooms and taking them to soccer and water polo and piano lessons and orthodontist. It was not that glamorous or exciting or, you know, I just carpooled the kids, basically. And it was just this very average life.
An average life, which she worked really hard to keep. But tonight, she's not going to run. Tonight, she's going to take a deep breath and enjoy the beauty surrounding her.
I was at my daughter's piano recital. And it was just this wonderful family moment. And she played a piece that was sort of Chopin's Nocturne, which is really kind of sad and melancholy, but rich, just beautiful. And I started thinking how wonderful my life was and how lucky, you know, just my family's great. They're so little angels I'm with and my husband and, you know, I had one of those, like it really hit home and I just breathing it all in.
But on that same night when she got home, her recurring nightmare returned, except this time she was wide awake.
And then it was right after that that I get this phone call, you know, just like the bubble pops.
Marie picks up the phone. It's her brother. He tells her that the men from her nightmares are coming for her.
The police are, you know, screaming at my, that they're all out there threatening to go into his house. And he's a very religious and, you know, he has these three children and his wife and there are just five police cars at his neighborhood. And they're saying they're going to go in and search his house.
Marie Walsh, whose real name is Susan, was not just a stay-at-home mom. She was a fugitive running from the law for 32 years. I'm Javier Leyva, and this is Pretend, stories about why people pretend to be someone else.
It was upsetting that you know, to get this call and have this keep this reoccurring nightmare keep emerging right when I was just trying to feel a little bit comfortable and a little take it for granted that everything, you know, how I have, you know, my life is stable. I can relax now. It's been so many years. And I just wanted to feel that I didn't have to always feel like this was like I was living on borrowed time.
Susan has been running from the law most of her adult life. And her family didn't even have a clue. Only a few people knew the truth. Her parents, her brother, a few friends from her past. But her husband and kids were left in the dark. She had too much to lose. She's come too far to get caught now. Did your family know about your secret life at the time?
Well, no. You know, when do you bring that up, by the way? But it would serve no purpose for me to tell them, and there could be a lot of complications, and then they could be legally, it would put them in jeopardy also. But I didn't want my family to, I didn't want it to define me, that I'd been, you know, done time and a prisoner and escaped a penitentiary. I mean, that was just some weird thing that happened to me. I just couldn't imagine being torn from my young children.
Authorities kept calling different family members trying to locate Susan. They're not really sure if she's in the country or if she's even alive at this point. But her family keeps calling and telling her they're coming for her. I mean, what do you do when you get a call like that? I mean, do you just go on living life as normal, or do you hit the road and run for it?
Well, I considered definitely hitting the road for a while, and I did start staying away, but I should have. I should have hid.
So it wasn't a big surprise when they showed up at your door.
I had knowledge that they were looking for me at that time for quite a few months.
So what the heck did she do? Did she kill someone? Did she rob a bank? Or rip somebody off? Nope. She's just an ordinary girl who got involved with the wrong crowd. Back in Michigan, where she grew up, Susan found herself in the middle of an undercover drug sting. And the results of that sting didn't go well. She was arrested and sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison. And how much drugs are we talking about? 500 grams? A kilo? Mm-mm. She says she was busted for 2.5 grams of heroin. That's basically a teaspoon of heroin. And get this, she says she wasn't even the one selling it. It was her friend named Richie. Richie sold the teaspoon of heroin to the undercover agent for $300. It was only worth $50 on the street. It was a stupid move. A move that landed them a sentence that would have put these 19-year-old kids in prison potentially into their 40s. And just to give you an idea, a first offense like this in Michigan would carry a sentence for up to 4 years in prison. 4 years. But she got 20.
I'm not going to run like an animal. I was innocent, so I'm sure the records will bear that out. It's been 30 years. I've been had an exemplary life. And I figured I would just face it and get it over with. Now a housewife living in the suburbs, keeping it secret that I was a fugitive, I did try and strive for as normal of a life as I could.
Is it in the back of your head that, hey, one day they could show up?
Well, I always told myself that it would be when I least expected it, because you're always thinking, you know, is this going to be it? Or you see a police car driving by and you're thinking, is this it? Is this it? I mean, but I know that it would be when I least expected it.
And sure enough, one morning, while planting succulents in her garden,
you know, it was just a very normal late morning day.
She gets approached by a man holding her mugshot. This is it. He tells her, I'm taking you in. Another agent appears as they walk back inside the house. Susan's daughter, Katie, was in the next room, and she walked in to see what was going on.
My daughter was 19.
The same age her mother, Susan, was when she was busted for drugs.
And I just told her not to worry, that it was something from a long time ago. And
so what happened after she was arrested that night back in Saginaw, Michigan? Susan spent the night in jail and posted bond the next morning. A week later, Susan says she found herself in a windowless room sitting across from a man she believed to be a prosecutor. She says the man behind the metal table told her that he knew she wasn't selling drugs. All he wants her to do is give up information on her Mexican boyfriend. It was simple. Tell us everything you know about your boyfriend and we'll drop the charges against you. Susan's Mexican boyfriend had a very familiar name. His name was Javier. Javier Carreras. Oh boy.
this would be Javier. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it was definitely Javier. Yeah. It was very unusual. They're a great name, huh?
Exactly. So it was a guy named Javier. Yeah. So, but he played a very important role in your story, because that's how you kind of got wrapped into this whole mess, right?
Yeah, but yeah, I guess I would be guilty of liking to date guys that are sort of, you know, I was adventurous. Javier was just real attractive and exotic, you know, and took me nice places, and then he had cocaine. You know, I'm sure he was a man about town dealer, a small time dealer, just, you know, maybe it's probably, but I mean, because you don't, he had a business which they usually, everybody does, but they don't tell you, yeah, I'm doing this as my deals and I go here. They don't tell you their business, especially when it's not legal, and I didn't really know him that well. But I know he did bring out cocaine, and it felt wonderful.
But according to Susan, they didn't even have evidence against her. She didn't have the drugs on her the day of the arrest. They had nothing. However, the prosecutor wasn't going to take no for an answer. He told her that if he decided to take this to trial, they would bury her. If she pleads guilty, she would only get probation for a year.
I pled guilty when I went back a few weeks later, thinking that I was getting the probation as promised.
So again, the deal is to plead guilty to a crime she says she didn't even commit, and she'll get probation. Simple enough. Susan didn't question it. But when her court date arrived, the prosecutor asked for the maximum sentence, and there was no mention of a plea deal. Susan recalls the judge saying, "Although you're young in age, I have the duty to society, and I'm sentencing you to prison."
They gave me 10 to 20 years.
Susan was off to the Detroit House of Corrections, afraid and alone. The whole time she was in jail, no one would visit her. Her family pretty much disowned her. It was terrifying. Susan says that guards would enter their cells and showers and molest and rape inmates. She always wondered if she was next. Every day she was consumed by one thought. She will be a middle-aged woman by the time she leaves prison. But despite her desperation, there was no way out. Yet that didn't stop people from escaping. She heard stories of some girls who had jumped the 20-foot-tall barbed-wired fence, only to be caught soon and returned to prison.
But they were full of information as far as escaping, and they told me, they told me stories about horror stories. They love to scare you, and the dogs would be let loose, and people got caught on the barbed wire and dangling there at the top and couldn't get off.
She pretty much gave up hope for leaving, until one day, someone came to prison to visit her.
They told me I had a visitor, and I don't even think they told me who it was. And so I went out to the visiting room a little bit, 20 minutes later, and here's my grandfather and my Aunt Mary Alice.
She didn't know how to react. She felt pretty ashamed.
My grandfather, I should say, was a pillar of community. I mean, he never, ever broke the law.
But her grandfather wasn't there to lecture her. He was there to break her out of prison.
And my grandfather really coaxed me to, that I should escape.
Escape? Yeah. He was determined to get Susan out of there. You see, Susan's father and uncle both convinced Susan to accept a guilty plea. And then they just disowned her. Grandpa knew Susan was falsely charged, and no one, not even her own father, was doing anything about it. Grandpa wasn't just going to sit there and watch his granddaughter rot in prison.
He broke because it was his son and his two sons, the lawyer, my uncle that's a lawyer, and my dad, who kind of were not helping me at all. And he came and he broke from everyone else and said, "No, this is wrong. What's happening to Susan?" And he came and he said, "And I'll even help you."
If she was going to escape, she needed to come up with a plan.
It was out in a desolate area, and it's like getting out of the area because, there'd be a lot of police cars and everything just searching all the roads and things and all these woods around there.
Did you tell him, "Are you crazy?" Like, what was his plan?
plotted out that I would go in the morning hours before dusk, because at night they were much keener. And in the morning, I kind of saw that people were a little more lax, and things were, they didn't expect much in the morning. And I had a special job where I went and worked at this clinic. Every morning I was going out before the sun came up, and I knew that, you know, I picked a time that I would go, and I would just go for the fence and run to it. It was quite a ways from the units and the walkway to the fence. It was quite a big area, so that it, you know, for security. And so I'd run to the fence and had to, you know, get over the barbed wire tall fence.
Susan used her jacket to cover the barbed wires, but it's not as easy as they make it look like in the movies.
You know, I still remember doing that, cut my hand on the barbed wire. I just still remember just jumping to the other side, and the ground was kind of still frozen. It was, I think it was February, and, you know, I had to make sure that there wasn't a snowfall at the time of year, because you don't want to be escaping in snowfall. They just, you know, they just follow your track.
Were there any, like, search lights or?
I heard the siren go off after I was running a while and I hadn't reported to work. And it had given me time, at least no one saw me under the cover of darkness of dusk at dawn. And so then the siren went off and the lights went on. And mainly I could hear the helicopter, but helicopters are the most inefficient way. If there's any trees, I mean, it's just, I don't know how they catch anybody. Maybe now with heat sensing devices, but at the time I just hid behind, up against a tree when the helicopter went over, and then started running again when it moved on. And I just kept running and running, and then I thought I was going to fall out from exhaustion, but I kept running. You know, my lungs were going to burst, but I just kept running. You know, I just knew that I had to find that extra energy. And then when I saw my grandfather's car in the distance, it was just a wonderful feeling. And my aunt was, she had the rosary right up to her face and was saying it on the passenger side of the car. And my grandfather was in the driver's seat, and I, you know, just jumped in the back seat and he drove off. And that was my driving off to freedom, and saved my life and gave me a wonderful, wonderful, you know, rich life.
And for the next 30 years, she nearly got away with it.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making Just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
This is what fascinates me about Fugitives. Escaping is the easy part. Getting away with it? Well, that's the long con. I had to ask Susan about the logistics of creating a new persona. First, you need a new name.
I used my middle name and made up a last name until I got married, and then I just used that.
You have to like figure things out. And in order to get money, you need a job, right? But you can't get a job without a proper ID. So how did you get around for so long without any like social security card or driver's license or birth certificate?
Well, it was a little different then.
She needed a license, so she took her chances going to the DMV. She filled out the application, turned it in, and hoped that it went through. And it did. Remember, things were a little bit more lax back then.
You could go into a company in the 80s and say, and they'd say, we need your social security, and you'd give them a fake social security number and they wouldn't find out for a year.
For a long time, Susan jumped from job to job. She would give them a fake social security number. And then, around tax time, the office manager would come around and tell her that her social security number bounced back. Susan would tell them that she would just look into it, and then the next day, she never showed up to work. She just kept bouncing from job to job, undetected.
And they wouldn't find out for a year and a bit when they go to do the taxes. And I would just make up a number.
Now it's when you're really living that double life, right? You go under your middle name, Marie, but you really have no money, and you really have no plan, right? But then, after a few months, things started to settle down. Susan met a businessman named Philip, and he was loaded. He had two yachts, one in the States, one in Australia, a home on the water, and a business. They started dating, and, well, one thing led to the other, and eventually he asked her to marry him. But if they were going to get married, she had to tell him the truth.
But, you know, I told Philip then, when we were really serious and going to get married.
At first, he couldn't believe it. He had so many questions. He wanted to hire a lawyer to help her clear her name. But that would take time, and it was risky. But there was no easy way out of this. Philip just started pulling away. The more real her situation became, the relationship never really stood a chance. But time went on, and she met the man she would eventually marry. His name was Alan, Alan Walsh. And when things got serious with Alan, she never really kept her troubled past a secret.
I told him that I'd left Michigan and my boyfriend got arrested, or, you know, and that he was sort of in using drugs and stuff. And so that there was somewhat shadiness or in the background, and I left there to get away from it all.
But she never really told him the truth either. Did you feel that same kind of responsibility of trying to tell him about your past?
I felt it, but I knew that I tried it. It did not work well. It was disastrous. It destroyed, you know, helped destroy a relationship. So I knew that I could not do that because it just had two long-term consequences. So I did tell him that things weren't, you know, that I'd had a lot of problems with my parents and such. And he basically kept saying, I tend to be a little long-winded. And he said, I don't care about your past. I've met your parents and they're fine. It's, you know, now is what's important. I know who you are. And so I kind of like, okay, great. I'll tell you another time. And it just never happened. But, you know, yeah, we had kids pretty soon and everything. And you get kind of sidetracked. And I didn't think it was a good idea, you know, to tell him. I didn't know what the benefit would be.
Fast forward 25 years, three kids later, Alan walks in one day on Susan frantically packing her suitcase. Remember, she just received a call from her brother saying that the authorities were looking for her. She figured she needed to get out of there before they break down her door looking for her.
He knew something was up, and I just had to say, just got to trust me. You know, it's nothing between you and me, and I just got to take care of some stuff that's, you know, I've got to take care of.
Alan doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't even know her real name. He begs her to give him answers. He pleads, Marie, what's going on? Who was on the phone? What are you doing? She says, I tried to tell you before, but you didn't want to know. he said, it's all right. Just tell me now. I mean, there's something serious going on. I need to know. What is it? Susan was worried that if her family knew any details about her double life, they would be charged as accomplices. So now everyone in the family knows that she's in trouble. They just don't know why. For the next couple weeks, Susan was living out of a hotel. She thought, this isn't gonna work. Who's gonna feed the dog? Who's gonna pack lunches? I need to go back home with my family. It was time to stop running. Then one spring morning in 2008, while Susan was gardening, her two worlds came crashing together. The U.S. Marshal outside her house pulls out a badge and asks her if she's Susan Lefevre. She says, no, I'm Marie Walsh. She stepped into the police car and she was transported from San Diego back to Michigan. Obviously, I'm talking to you right now and you're not in jail. So what happened? Like, how did this get resolved?
Well, they transported me back to Michigan then, against what the parole officer looking for me said, that, oh, they'll probably release you right away. They took me back. It took a week and I was in shackles for 7 days, 24 hours a day, 7 days. They'd get me in a room, the guards, several guards, and tell me I wasn't leaving there alive. They'd put me in with people that were known as very violent, that they never put with people.
You know, it's important to note that Susan says that she actually tried to turn herself in several times through a hired attorney. But she says that the DA back in Michigan didn't want to touch the case.
This is the ironic part. And instead, they spend millions of dollars checking all over the country with my relatives. When I had called the prosecutor in Saginaw, Mike Thomas, and offered to turn myself in twice, and he said, stay away. And they did not want my case.
I don't think anybody would ever advocate for becoming a fugitive. But I mean, looking back now, I mean, would you do it all over again?
That's a weird question.
She told me that she appreciates the life she lived outside of prison, but wouldn't want to relive the pain and suffering that she put her family through.
It was a good thing in many ways that I was able to not be a fugitive anymore. And that is, you know, it was embarrassing to have people know that your mom was an accused drug kingpin.
Do you still have a relationship with your kids?
They're still sort of overwhelmed, I guess, by the whole thing. Yeah, I do. It's just they still, you know, they never want to talk about it. They feel, there are still residual feelings. And I kind of think, you know, I don't know. And I just feel like it was a tragic thing that happened to our family. But, you know, I went through a lot too. My middle daughter, she's always felt like very supportive of me and felt like she totally gets it that, you know, I hadn't done anything that a lot of her and her friends hadn't done. And it was just a bad deal type of thing. And she's proud of me that I made the best of it and went on to have a good life. But my other kids are still, it's, and even my husband, it was just a little more than they could. They're still sort of overwhelmed, I guess.
But if Susan would have never gone through this, she would have never discovered her true passion, prison reform. Since leaving prison, Susan has championed for a woman who also got a raw deal. Her name is Tracy Cohen. Before getting arrested, Tracy had a clean record, but she got wrapped into her boyfriend's drug dealings. Because of her crime, she now faces 40 years in prison. She could be serving less time, but she got busted before the state of Michigan loosened their sentencing laws.
Been working for a couple years now on a woman who's in prison for some cocaine in her basement that her boyfriend put there. And whether she knew about it or not, I don't, you know, she's been in prison 17 years. Beautiful, articulate woman. I've met her, you know her, she's remarkable. She's in prison 17 years now. So when people say that there's reforms happening all the time, that they're no longer being as bad as they used to be.
Did you know? Women have been the fastest growing incarceration population in the country. Since the 1970s, the number of women inmates has exponentially grown from 8,000 women arrested in 1970 to nearly 220,000 women incarcerated in 2018.
Women incarceration went up, I think, 700%, whereas men went up 400% during the 80s. But women went up 700% from when the drug war started.
The vast majority of women, like Tracy, are in jail for nonviolent offenses like drugs. And typically, the punishment is disproportionate to the crime.
This woman, and I'm sure there's many like her, but her case is just, I know her children, and they just will not let her out. One-time offense, no proof that she was even involved. They knew it was her boyfriend, that he kept it in her basement, where she had her three kids.
Congress recently passed a bipartisan prison reform bill called the First Act. And this will bring much needed relief for prisoners and their families. But we as a country have a long way to go. This bill is really just that, the first steps.
They don't even bother to investigate the big traffickers because they get just as much compensation for putting in some guy in the street of Detroit, some woman like Tracy with her three kids has got some dope in the basement somehow.
Susan began writing her autobiography in prison. It's titled A Tale of Two Lives, the Susan Lefevre Fugitive Story.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
Next time on Pretend.
So these are all
warrants.
All these people are you have to.
Yeah, they're classified. I just pull one out that day. Let's just say Ashley Walker.
Jack Saltarelli is a bounty hunter.
It's a misdemeanor.
His job is to hunt down fugitives.
They don't go to court. You got to hunt them. This is a warrant that we run with.
What was she in for?
Well, I don't know. It usually just says failure to appear.
So you don't
we
know.
Go, no, just... it could be murder. It could be DUI. We find out. We pull them up on the screen at the jail to see what we're dealing with. But you never know.
You don't
and
know
it's
what
all kind. We got guys in there. Homicides, rapes, just everything. Petty larceny, fraud.
But that could be kind of dangerous, right? Like you're just pulling up a folder and you're supposed to find this person?
Well, this is all I do. This is all I've been doing for 29 years. And some are funny. Some are serious, scary. When you're going in a house, whether you got with three or four guys with you, and you're going in dark closets, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to see that flash. You don't know. But you're doing it because you like what you're doing. You love it. I've been across country chasing child molesters. I'll go after them all day long. Rapists, I'll go after them all day long. But if I have to go out 10 times that week, I love it. It's what I do. I'm cleaning streets. And people don't realize how many, you saw the boxes. They don't realize how many people are running out there, fugitives, that are just blending in with people, committing crimes to survive because they can't work regular jobs. They're out there. They're all over the place. They're like insects. And we go after them.
But Jack is not your ordinary bounty hunter. He's hiding his own secret. And on our next episode, he's coming clean. I hope you guys are enjoying the Fugitive series as much as I am. This episode was edited by Logan Casterdale. She is awesome. And of course, music by the great Joe Basile with thechicken.net. So, last time, I mentioned that I'm trying to collect stories about lies, just like we did a couple seasons ago. And I've gotten a pretty good response, but there's still time to call in leave me a voicemail about a situation where someone has lied to you, or maybe you lied. Maybe it was a little white lie. Maybe it was a big lie. So I set up a voice line so you can call and leave me a message whenever you want. The number is 919-444-2280. Again, the number is 919-444-2280. And don't worry, I'll leave the number in the show notes. And just a reminder, because it's coming up on July 13th, I will be part of a panel for the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago. So if you're anywhere near that area, you should totally come, because there's going to be so many podcasters there. Check it out on their website, tcpf2019.com. There's going to be so many great shows. You don't want to miss it. Okay, guys. Well, I'll see you in 2 weeks with the next fugitive story. You're going to love Jack.
It is in human nature to have extremely enjoyable feelings that make you feel guilty. Join me, your host, the one and only Father Sin, every week while I delve into the inner workings of the human mind in my own twisted and sinful way on The Sinful Show, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast, which was nominated as one of the best British true crime podcasts of 2018. It's based on my 5-star rated guided walk and features more than 300 untold, unsolved, and long forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of London's West End. So if you love hearing about new cases for the first time, all cases through a fresh pair of ears, and classic cases with a twist, all researched using the original declassified police investigation files, written using first-hand accounts, and recorded using authentic sounds from the murder location itself, then Murder Mile is just for you. Download the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast on iTunes, Acast, or your favorite podcast platform every Thursday. Thank you for listening, and stay safe.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. Our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Creative Babble.